Welcome to the Bill Kelly Podcast. I'm Bill Kelly. While Ontario continues to face massive labor shortages across a variety of industries, how can we prepare for the workforce of tomorrow? Despite a decline in general inflation, grocery prices continued to skyrocket. Matter of fact, they've doubled the rate of just about everything else. That could mean more rate hikes after the Bank of Canada has a look at that. How can we get inflation under control? And what's happening at Roxham Road? Tasha Curran, principal at Navigator and an author of The Right Path, will join us to discuss that issue. All coming up in the Bill Kelly Podcast, and it starts now.
Today on the Bill Kelly Show on 900 CHML.
Things changed dramatically, of course, as we know, through the course of the pandemic. Is it going to go back to the way things were? Or are employers starting to look outside the box to find some things? Well, here's a poll that was recently done that suggests that 81% of Canadian workers want flexible work arrangements and are willing to leave their job if they don't get it. Don Kelly has details.
The survey by Cisco Canada indicates that while employees increasingly expect flexibility, employers continue to see hybrid work arrangements as a perk. Flexibility emerged as a top priority for workers in the survey, second only to salary. The survey also found most employers are tightening hybrid work policies and bringing in mandatory office days, considering hybrid work as a benefit, while employees feel like it's expected. Don Kelly, The Canadian Press, Toronto.
Which ties very nicely into what our next guest is going to talk about. The Ontario Chamber of Commerce has been studying this too, and there's an open letter that their CEO and president has written. It's called "We Need to Prepare Now for the Workforce of Tomorrow." Rocco Rossi, of course, is who we're talking about, the president and CEO of the Ontario Chamber of Commerce, and he joins us here on the Bill Kelly Show to talk about this. Rocco, been a while. Thanks for joining us on the program today.
Always a pleasure, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about this, because we've been talking around this issue for some time, and I know there have been a number of surveys done about what it's going to look like, hybrid work, remote work, or is it going to go back to the way things were pre-COVID? I got the sense from the open letter that you wrote here that we can't afford to go back to the way things were. It's a changing world, and here in Ontario, we have to adopt to that change.
Well, first off, I want to point out that this actually doesn't apply to the entire economy. There are a ton of people, heroes, who have to wake up every day and go into their place of work, whether it's in construction or stocking shelves in grocery stores or pharmacy. They can't do that on their laptop. And that is still a significant portion of the population. For within those that, you know, some are calling the laptop class, or people where there is that flexibility, there's no question that there are enormous advantages from having flexibility, but flexibility doesn't mean never be in the office. It is important for productivity, for brainstorming, for building out corporate culture, that people spend some time in the office, and getting that balance is important. But flexibility is also enabling lots of people to be able to, for instance, raise their family. And this unfortunately still affects more women than men as the primary child rearers. That additional flexibility is crucial, and at a time when there are massive labor shortages across the economy, employers are being very careful about how insistent, because they are concerned that if others provide more flexibility, they'll lose key employees in a tight labor market.
Yeah, as I read your piece last night, and it's fascinating. It's I think an indicator of where we need to go and where the employers need to go, where the government needs to go too, with the mindset. It kind of reminded me of discussions you and I've had over the years about flexibility in this workplace and how other parts of the globe have been doing it differently. Some places in Europe, certainly in Scandinavia, and in some Asian countries where they've already adopted these flex hours and more flexibility for employers, maybe even more time off. We're going to talk later in the program today about a 4-day work week. And more times than not, Rocco, as you and I both know, that in the past, anytime anybody brought those things up, it was, nope, production's going to fall off. We just can't do that. Sorry, I don't care what they're doing over there. And it was, you know, you're going to work Monday to Friday, you're going to do your 40 hours, and you're going to get your 2 weeks holidays or 3 weeks or whatever it is. I think the times are changing, and I think most employers are starting to understand that now, aren't they?
100%. And you know, we've effectively had a almost 3-year forced experiment because of COVID that blew up a lot of the myths of what is possible and what isn't. That said, it also underscores the challenges in a number of areas, because not all entities are as well provided, if you will, in terms of the infrastructure of remote work. There are some jobs where you'd like to think it could be done remotely, but it can't. I'll give you a perfect example. It involves the government, and another issue that's actually exacerbating the labor issue, and that is immigration. Mm-hmm. The immigration process is not Shopify. It is still largely paper-based. And that requires people to actually be in the office, because they can't take passports home with them or visa information home with them. And so if you don't have that capability, that full-time capability to be able to do all of that work remotely, you have to, in effect, insist that people are in the office as you are building up that capability, because otherwise what's happening is a massive backlog in that work. And that's just one example. In another area, I think about young people beginning their career. It is relatively easy, you know, for gray hairs like you and me, who've been brought up in a specific culture, potentially to do more remotely. But someone just beginning their career, most of what I learned, as I'm sure you learned, was by osmosis within the office, watching managers do good and bad things to learn about how to better myself within that culture. And we're losing that opportunity, because that's not so easy to do on Teams or Zoom.
And again, as you say, that's going to vary from occupation to occupation and job to job. There are some things where, you know, that flexibility that we've talked about may not be as achievable. And you mentioned could be in the agri-food sections, a number of different things that are going on. And those all need help. And that kind of circles back to what you and I have talked about since this pandemic began, certainly. But even before that, I think, is skilled trades and the number of skilled trades openings that there are these days. I mean, you know, there's some very qualified, very capable, and very successful people in all of these endeavors. But you use the term gray hairs, Rocco. I mean, you know, a lot of them are retiring now because they figured, okay, it's time to move on. And there aren't enough people to fill those gaps that have those same skills.
It is something that absolutely keeps me up at night, because you're right. If you take a look at the average journeyman and pick the trade from carpenter to electrician to welder in the province of Ontario, it's in the high 50s. And so we're aging out in key areas that are going to be required for all of these, you know, massive infrastructure programs that have been announced, from transit to nuclear reactor refurbishments, to building out the electricity grid for the green transition. And we've spent a couple of generations telling our kids in school, well, if you're really smart, you need to go to university. Not quite so smart, we'll get you to community college. If you don't make the grade, maybe we'll find a trade for you. And the net result of that is my plumber can buy and sell me four times over. He's got a place in Georgian Bay, another in Scottsdale, and runs a phenomenal business. The average welder at the Darlington nuclear plant refurbishment right now is making between $150,000 and $200,000 a year. You talk about a pathway to middle class and better. There are great opportunities, and there are necessities for the economy. So, for instance, even as immigration is happening, we need people who not only want to buy houses, we need people who know how to build houses. And so that's got to be part of the filtering process, to be strategic about this incredible opportunity we have as a country that continues to be a magnet for people from around the world.
Yeah, we just had the president and CEO of the Home Builders Association on yesterday. He says, these goals the province is setting are fabulous and laudable, but who's going to build them? We don't have enough people. So I get where you're coming from. And you talk about that, Rocco, in the piece that I read last night, about a skills mismatch that's occurring here. And you're concerned that it's only going to get worse. Explain that to us.
Well, look, we've known for a long time, as with most developed economies, that we're aging out. We have a rapidly aging population, and absent immigration, we're actually shrinking. So as people come to retirement age, you're having a lot of people leave areas, and we've not really thought through, despite the fact that this was completely predictable. I mean, the actuarial tables, you knew in the year 2000 who would be, rough numbers, how many 25-year-olds you would have in 2025. There's no surprise there, plus or minus a little bit with immigration. And you could predict those numbers. You knew how many retirees there were going to be. Back in the 1950s, there were four people working for every person retired. By the 2050s, you'll actually have almost an even number of those working, those retiring, and then you start turning to fewer people working versus those retired. So think about what that means to taxes. Think about what that means to keep pensions sustainable, to keep our social services network sustainable. And you'll see what we're talking about as a key strategic area that governments, schools, and society need to be talking about and need to be acting on immediately.
Well, and as you say, it's market driven to a certain extent. And you mentioned about your plumber having a nice place up in Georgian Bay. A lot of us gravitated up there during the pandemic, you know, first of all, to get away from the city for a variety of reasons. And then now we're starting to see a movement here, almost an exodus into some of these areas. Good luck finding a tradesperson. You want to build a deck? Not going to happen anytime soon. You want to get the pipes fixed? We really need those people. But is the province doing enough to encourage and channel people into those endeavors and into those trades? I mean, as you say, the pay is lucrative. The hours are pretty good. But generationally, we've not really done a whole lot to encourage people to say this is a great idea and a great way to make a living and contribute to the economy.
I want to give a big tip of the hat to Labor Minister Monty McNaughton, who's really been beating the drum on this and taken a number of really crucial steps. We're also seeing it in the healthcare area, the recent announcement. I mean, think about this, Bill. They had to announce that nurses trained in the rest of Canada, not foreign trained nurses, you know, people from Manitoba and Quebec and BC, can, as of right, work as nurses within Ontario. So we've had these barriers, and we still have them in a number of professions where you do not have labor mobility across this country. How is that possible? How does that make any kind of sense in a time of labor shortages to do that? How does it make sense that we give people points in the immigration process if they've been trained in skills that we need? And then when we come here, we don't recognize those skills. We don't recognize those credentials. They're caught in this ridiculous, vicious circle that makes no sense and hurts both them and our economy. So the credentialing area is a key part. We need to do more within our education system, but we also have to look ourselves in the mirror and be encouraging our kids to look at broader options for what kind of careers they want to pursue, because that mismatch in skills is also about you want to look at what the market needs are going to be and give people appropriate information about what choices are out there and what things could offer lucrative paths for them to build a life for themselves and their families.
We're just about out of time, but I just want to give a shout out to Minister McNaughton too. We've had him on the program a number of times, and this is a passion for him, and we need more of that passion, I think, to try to move the yardsticks as far as it goes. It's a great piece. It's called "We Need to Prepare Now for the Workforce of Tomorrow," and it's not something in the hypothetical. It's something that has to happen now. Rocco, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for the time today.
Thanks, as always, for shining a light on these key business issues, my friend.
Take care. Rocco Rossi, the president and CEO of the Ontario Chamber of Commerce.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Statistics Canada says headline inflation was down from 6.3% in December, noting the annual inflation rate will continue to slow in the coming months. The last time inflation was below 6% was in February of last year, when it was at 5.7%. The headline rate came in lower in January than many commercial banks were anticipating in their forecasts, signaling good news for the Bank of Canada. From the Canadian Press Business Desk, I'm Lisa Laporte.
All right, so we know that inflation has gone down, maybe even a little more than they had anticipated, but what does that mean, and how are the banks going to react, and how are you going to react? This is the Bill Kelly Show, CFPL London, CHML Hamilton. To get some insight into this, please to welcome back to the program Moshe Landau, who's a senior economics lecturer at Concordia University. Moshe, thanks so much for the time. Good to have you with us again today.
Good morning.
Are we in a vicious cycle here? To try to beat inflation, we have to keep prices low. Prices are not getting low. Does that mean we have to raise interest rates even higher, even though inflation seems to be going down incrementally?
Possibly. It really depends on how credible people believe the Bank of Canada is in bringing inflation down to 2%. Mm. So if everybody believes that they're going to accomplish their goal within the next 12 months, like they say, then you would assume that some of this pricing pressure and this opportunism by some firms would stop. But if people don't believe that the Bank of Canada is credible, if the Bank of Canada is saying 2% in the next 12 months and people say, yeah, I really think it's going to be 4, then you can understand why businesses would be apprehensive about only increasing their prices 2%.
So somebody has to blink here, though, don't they?
Yeah, and unfortunately, the Bank of Canada is going to win this blinking contest, right? Because they have an unlimited capacity to raise interest rates. So if businesses refuse to get it through their heads that this is going to stop and soon, then the Bank of Canada, like they said, they can just increase interest rates until people realize that they do mean business.
How close are we to what I think could be a bad move, in some cases a catastrophic move, where the government looks at this cycle that we've just talked about and says, okay, we have to step in here? Because they've tried to do that in the past with things like wage and price controls, and it was a colossal failure. But that doesn't mean they wouldn't try something like that again.
I would like to think that our current prime minister heard a couple of things at the dinner table when he was a child about price controls and maybe learned a lesson of what damage that can do to a party if you try that sort of thing. So I'm hoping that as long as he's the prime minister and as long as that's the party in power, I don't know that we're going to see that type of catastrophic decision making take place.
I concur, by the way, and I'd like to think that he did get that was that should have been one of the takeaways from the dinner table back in those days, because it's like the old adage. I mean, there's a balance here. There's as soon as you start messing up with the balance of nature, you mess things up. Economics is pretty much the same way, isn't it? When you try to insert something and say, wait a second here, I think I can help. Invariably, you mess up that balance, and who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, and usually, I mean, I'm one of those economists that generally believes in the power of the market. And so government intervention is usually only justified when you have, say, some sort of abuse of market power. And usually the correction there is not necessarily price control, but trying to eliminate the market power, or where you have something called externalities, where your decision is spilling over and interfering with somebody else's ability to make their decisions. But outside of that, usually governments don't need to get involved in these sorts of price controls. This is just the market naturally reacting to the incentives that are placed in front of it. And so if the issue here is that businesses are taking advantage of the opportunity to raise their prices unnecessarily, then remove that impetus and higher interest rates and raising borrowing costs and trying to slow down the economy is a really good elixir to counteract that behavior.
And I think the governor, Tiff Macklin, the Bank of Canada governor, that is, made that clear, I think, last week when he was before the parliamentary committee, when he said he hit the pause button, he said it was just the pause button. He says, I'm not shutting this thing down. He seemed to indicate that the high prices are still going to be a factor here. And it seems to me anyway, Moshe, that he would show no hesitation at all to get right back on the interest hike, paradigm once again, if he realizes that's the only way he's going to be able to stop this.
Yeah, I think Canadians should not underestimate the person that's in charge of the Bank of Canada. It's not some random schmo that they picked off the street, right? It's not I'm in charge of monetary policy here. This is somebody who's extremely skilled and knowledgeable in how interest rates work and how the economy functions. And he's not sitting there looking into some crystal ball deciding that I wonder what this will do. They have extremely advanced models that simulate all kinds of possible responses to these interest rate hikes. And so it's still an inexact science, but it's a science. And so the reality is that he knows what he's doing, and he has a bunch of people up at the senior level of the Bank of Canada that know what they're doing too. And so I think if they're talking about a pause, or if they have to unpause, they have a rough idea of what they're doing. And so I think we should take it seriously.
Well, when you listen to Macklem's comments last week, and they echo the comments of, well, his U.S. counterpart from the Federal Reserve, of course, Jerome Powell, and even Canadian labor economist Jim Stanford, who's been a guest on this show many times, they, I don't want to necessarily say it's finger pointing, but they're saying, don't blame us for doing this. Talk to the people that are raising prices. They're the ones that are actually throwing fuel on the fire here. Is that a legitimate claim?
Yeah, for sure. Look, if input costs are rising because of supply chain issues, and you pass along that cost, that makes business sense. If what you're doing is sensing that there's this gap in the marketplace here, and so through opportunism, you're just increasing your price because you have this market power, that's not acceptable. And that's exactly what I was saying a few minutes ago, where, you know, if the government did want to get involved and take some sort of action, it's not through price control, but it's through punishing people that are opportunists. And one way that you can do that is by introducing competition, which is something that's increasingly disappearing from this country, and allowing these sorts of behaviors by businesses to take place. So it's not the Bank of Canada. It's maybe the absence of competition that would keep a check on those price increases.
Well, and to that end, there has been some finger pointing. Loblaws, some of the other grocery giants, some MPs want to haul them up there and say, hey, what do you guys think you're doing, et cetera. Loblaws announced that they're going to reveal what they call corporate results today, that are getting an indicator as to whether or not the food retailer is actually overpricing goods. I'm not a betting man, Moshe, but I'm going to say, hey, nothing to see here. We're just doing fine. Thank you very much. We're just scraping by like you guys are. Is there a little fact and fiction in that, or is it leaning one way or the other?
Yeah. I don't think that they're going to come out and say our internal review has revealed that, yes, we have been price gouging. Right? that would be a little bit of a suicidal sort of behavior by a business. So, yeah, of course, they're going to say that, no, everything that we've done is within reason. But, you know, one way that I would present it is, let's say that my cost is a dollar, and I mark up my prices 100%. That means that I would be selling a product that costs me a dollar for $2. Let's say that my suppliers increase their prices so that it now costs me $1.50. If I'm marking up 100%, I'm not going to charge $3. What you would see on the other side is that my profit margin has gone from a dollar to $1.50, and you could accuse me then of taking advantage of the situation. But I would counter that I'm doing exactly what I've always done, which is just mark up 100%. That sort of situation then is where we start getting into, you know, parsing words and trying to figure out, is what they're doing responsible, ethical, or just good business.
But this is the chicken and egg argument, isn't it? It's just because, you know, the cost of living and inflation has gone up that all of a sudden you're noticing it. We talked about that yesterday on the program with this April 1st increase and the tax on liquor in the Canadian. It's a Canadian policy, of course. It's happened before, but we didn't pay much attention to it because, well, inflation was down and, you know, okay, it went up a couple of cents, but big deal. But when you're paying more for everything and then you see the price of lettuce, you're jumping up and down. And you might say, well, that's just the circumstance. But is it valid to use a follow-up question? Yeah, but you created the circumstance, didn't you?
Well, I think that the circumstance was supply chain issues, and that I don't think that was businesses doing, right? That was COVID, and that was the responses of governments to try and ensure the safety of its citizens, right? So this is the unintended consequence of that behavior and that decision. If businesses then take that opportunity to try and boost their profitability, again, that's the ethical element, right? From a good business standpoint, good business is that you take advantage of the opportunities when they present themselves to boost your bottom line. And so, we have this trade-off here where on the one hand, if you're a shareholder, you're going to shrug and say, I don't see anything wrong with what went on. But if you're a customer on the other end, you have a problem with it, vote with your feet. Go to a competitor that didn't take advantage. We've seen, for example, I think it was Pizza is offering some guarantee that they're not increasing prices for all of 2023, probably to steal a march on Little Caesars and Domino's and say that, look, if they want to increase their prices, they're perfectly allowed to. But if you find that objectionable, come buy your pizza here.
Well, it'd be interesting to see just what this report says. I guess, quick, I know we're just about out of time here. Do we look further up the chain then? Instead of looking at Loblaws and Metro and Sobeys, do we say, okay, who's supplying that stuff? Maybe that's the problem, or is it just a systemic problem?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right, Bill. And that's the thing, is that the forward-facing element is Loblaws. And so it's easy for us to put our attack on them because that's what we see. If you start going up that supply chain, we start entering into firms that we've never heard of. And so it's hard to be angry at somebody that you don't even know exists.
Yeah. Well, Galen Weston is the face, so I guess he's going to have to bear some of the brunt for this. Moshe, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for this today. Really appreciate it.
Anytime.
Take care. Moshe Lander, Senior Economics Lecturer at Concordia University in Montreal.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We mentioned about how the Liberals, federal Liberals, that is, have not fared very well in Quebec in the last little while when it comes to some of the national polling. And the main problem for that is quite simple, of course. They count on provinces like Quebec, especially for that solid base of votes. If, in fact, the next federal election comes along anytime soon, they need Quebec, and they need Ontario as well. But Quebec is a key part to that, and it may or may not be happening now. The bloc is solid, we know that. But one of the reasons for some of the frustration and maybe some of the trouble the federal Liberals seem to be having in garnering support in Quebec right now is because the Prime Minister and the Premier are butting heads on a number of key issues. One is the healthcare deal, of course. The other is immigration. And to that end, there has been a big kerfuffle, I think justifiably so, about Roxham Road, which is basically an illegal entry point for people that want to come into this country and seek asylum. Premier Legault has been very upset about that in the last little while. I'm sure you've seen some of the coverage on this on the national news. The Prime Minister, though, is being defensive about this and saying that closing the busy Roxham Road border crossing would only increase irregular migration between Canada and the U.S. The Prime Minister told reporters that putting up barricades at the Quebec crossing would not solve the problem.
The problem is we have 6,000 kilometers worth of undefended shared border with the United States. And as we saw with tragedies at Emerson, as we've seen in challenges elsewhere across the country, people will choose to cross elsewhere.
All right, that's his stand, and he seems to be sticking to it. The Premier has a much different idea. Opposition leader Pierre Poilievre has a much different idea, and they're actually accusing the Prime Minister of dragging his heels on this. A great piece about this from our next guest, Tasha Carradin, is the principal at Navigator and author of a book called The Right Path, an interesting read to be sure about the Canadian political scene going forward. Tasha, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, yeah, how many years ago did we look at what was going on at the American-Mexican border and say, oh, boy, thank God that sort of thing doesn't happen here? It has been happening here for quite some time, and it just seems that every now and then we get laser-focused on it. There was some terrible incidences in Quebec where some people died a couple of years ago in wicked winter weather. It's like we're having here in southern Ontario now. But now the focus now seems to be on Roxham Road, which is not a new problem. It's been there for quite some time. We need a solution to this. I think everybody's agreed upon that. But the Prime Minister's mindset here seems to be, let's negotiate. Well, that could take months or years if they're even going to negotiate at all, couldn't it?
It could. It should have been done long ago. If we take our minds back to how this all started, it was in 2017. Donald Trump was in the White House. We were renegotiating NAFTA. He had his his Muslim ban edict that came out that prohibited travel from six majority Muslim countries. And then Justin Trudeau tweeted out, "We welcome people of all faiths, you know, welcome to Canada." Roxham Road really ramped up after that, as well as another edict against Haitian refugees in the U.S. overstaying visas that Donald Trump also made. So you had this rush to Roxham Road that from a trickle became a flood of people. And Justin Trudeau at that time, I understand why in the immediate frame he didn't poke the bear, so to speak, because we were renegotiating NAFTA. There was a lot of tension with the Trump administration. But since then, you know, we have a friendly administration in now. There's no excuse to not deal with this. Negotiations don't have to take forever. I think that he should make it a priority. If he doesn't make it a priority, yes, it will drag on.
Well, talk to us about priorities then, because some of the coverage I'm hearing from different people that have had some opportunity to weigh in on this have said that the deal we're talking about here, by the way, is called the Safe Third Country Agreement between Canada and the U.S. Just for context here, does the U.S. have any interest at all in renegotiating that deal, or do we even know that yet?
Well, this is the thing. We know that the United States seems to be seeing this also as an opportunity to send potential refugee claimants out of the country. New York City is actually paying people to take buses to the border to get rid of their potential refugee problem. Why? Because they see it as a drain on social services, the same as the way Quebec sees it, that people are coming in an uncontrolled way, in large numbers, all at once. Our social services are already taxed, healthcare, education to the max because of the pandemic and the economy. So it's the absolute wrong time to have this additional pressure. So yeah, the U.S., to your point, I think if I was a cynic, would say, no, they don't really have an incentive. But at the same time, you know, they want our collaboration on other things, including, interestingly enough, national security issues now around China in particular, that the U.S. is taking very seriously, and that Canada is seen as a real weak link, as we now know from recent revelations. So, you know, if Trudeau were to get his act together on that piece and say, look, we'll fix things for you there. We'll tighten stuff up. We'll pass a foreign agents registry, the kinds of things the U.S. has already done. Maybe that would give some incentive for them to then say, OK, we will quid pro quo renegotiate this deal on the border and make it so there are no loopholes. Because the problem with that agreement is it creates a huge loophole for illegal points of entry. If you expanded it and simply said that anyone who comes to another country after being in a first safe country, whichever way they get there, can be turned back, then we wouldn't have this problem. But it doesn't say that. It only says if you cross legally that you could be turned back, and that's the problem.
So let's talk about the logistics here, and your point's well taken, because I saw one of the commentators, I think it was on Vashi Kapal's show last night, simply saying, you know, will Biden and Trudeau talk about this when they have their meeting in Ottawa next month? Oh, it's too soon. But this has been going on for 6 years. It's not too soon. Somebody somewhere down the diplomatic chain must have had this on their radar and talking about it, or have they?
I'm not sure if it's on the diplomatic piece. I think it is really, it became an issue for a number of reasons, also because, and again, this is political. You know, the problem seemed, first of all, contained to Quebec, because that was the main focus of the crossing. So the rest of the country didn't see it. Politically, it wasn't an issue for the rest of the country, for the Liberals. But secondly, also, a lot of the people who are crossing, there's a large Haitian community in Montreal. And if you know what's happening in Haiti right now, it's a disaster, humanitarian disaster. Nobody wants to go back. So those Haitian payments that I mentioned earlier, that Donald Trump had said, you can't stay here, you've got to go back. And he reversed a policy that allowed them to stay longer. If Justin Trudeau is down, will that implicate, or that will affect that community? And this a large community, actually, I think also in his riding, if I'm not mistaken. So that may be a political factor. And the problem with that is that there are ways to handle that. They could make claims in the United States. There are other ways, humanitarian ways, one could say, that people could get faster processing or whatever. But the point is, they aren't, it's, we can't just let people cross into the country illegally in large numbers in an uncontrolled way. It's also a security issue. Because if anyone does have malign intent to our country, it's a perfect backdoor to come, you know, negative things to our democracy or to who knows what else.
Well, and I don't know if we can learn from the U.S.-Mexico border. We're not going to build a wall, by the way, notwithstanding what some people suggested. But they did try to alter some of the processes there, did they not? Where it said, okay, fine, you have to actually qualify on that side of the border, and then you can come over. I don't know how well that worked, but it's, an option here. But that puts the onus on the U.S. then, and I'm not so sure they'd be comfortable with that.
Well, here's the thing. We don't know until we try. And what we do know is we've spent $93 million last year, $93 million on hotel rooms on this side of the border to accommodate newcomers or potential refugee claimants who, in many cases, weren't even filling those rooms. So the problem is you've created an entire industry around this, right? You've got hotels on this side of the border that are booked up thanks to the government. They don't want this situation to end. It's money for them. You've got taxi drivers on the south side of the U.S. who are making, you know, money. And in fact, even there was a border agent. There was a law enforcement professional in the United States who was moonlighting, driving people for $60 a pop from the bus station to the border in New York State. Like there's all sorts of crazy stuff that's grown up because we haven't dealt with this, as you pointed out, in the last 6 years. So it is time to deal with it. And we have to try. And I think, yes, that is a perfect opportunity for Trudeau to raise it when the two of them do meet in Ottawa.
You mentioned the politics, and that's going to permeate just about every aspect of this. Pierre Poilievre, of course, jumped right up and said, well, the government's got to shut it down right now. Is that a pragmatic solution? Is it a practical solution that to simply say, okay, no more? Or even on the short term, it seems as if there may be some merit to the Prime Minister's assertion that it's like whack-a-mole. It's just going to move the problem someplace else.
It will move the problem someplace else. I'm not sure what he meant by shut it down, put a barricade so people physically can't cross. The thing is, the third safe country agreement doesn't give us the capacity to just to turn people away. We can turn them away at legal crossings. It doesn't say illegal. So unless there's a loophole that we could exploit and say we declare the entire border to be a legal crossing, but if you cross anywhere, we're considering you legally crossing and therefore we can turn you back. I think lawyers maybe should take a look at it too, but you know, short of that, it is whack-a-mole. You close down the crossing at Roxham, people are going to cross elsewhere, and the other option is to declare Roxham a legal place. That's one thing you could do, is just, you know, put up a little hut there with a guard and say, this is now a legal crossing point. We declare it so. That he could do. Will people find another spot close to it? Maybe. But that would be, I think, perhaps the only immediate solution to that particular spot.
That's an interesting aspect of this, too. I mean, it's almost like it's a catch-22, isn't it, Tasha? That, you know, the agreement itself, the safe third party or third country agreement, talks about legal crossings. So you can't say, oh, by the way, if you're going to cross illegally, this is the process. I mean, that seems somewhat counterproductive to having an agreement, doesn't it?
Well, right. And I think it is the loophole that people either didn't foresee or didn't think would be exploited in this way. Maybe they didn't think people would be that desperate or take the risks because, you know, it wasn't just 2 years ago. A man died recently crossing at the same spot near Roxham. He was improperly dressed for the weather and he froze to death. So, you know, desperate people will do desperate things, but we don't want to put them in that situation either because it can have a horrible outcome.
Just to cover up on the politics once again, it's not unusual, of course, for Trudeau and Poilievre to be butting heads on this. So they do probably just about everything. Contrary points of view, whether or not today's Thursday, I guess, if you were to ask them. But Sean Fraser stepped into this. He's the education or immigration minister, rather. He seems very sympathetic to Quebec's situation right now, saying, look, this is putting way too much pressure on them. I think we can do something here. So it sounds like cooler heads are prevailing here. If you can just ignore the political theater here for a second, there seems to be a real desire to try to find a solution.
Well, there could be. I mean, I hope so. And it's the kind of thing that resonates with people because there's a fairness element to it as well. And that's what the Liberals have to be careful. You know, it is now going beyond the borders of Quebec in terms of a news story. It is also something that people look at and go, well, wait a minute. I, as a newcomer, it's not just people who were born in Canada who the stereotype, oh, they don't want people to jump the queue. No. If you're a newcomer to Canada and you waited patiently in your home country to come here, you went through a legal process, you know, is it fair that someone else can just jump the queue, whereas you maybe even have still relatives in that country that are waiting patiently, have gone through the hoops? It makes people angry on a very large number of different metrics. So I think liberals have to be careful about that, because this is becoming a fairness story, not simply a Quebec story.
And like you say, the pretext, the context of this is this pressure right now in Canada to do something about what's going on in Haiti, and so this is front and center for them. I mean, you know, they've got them at the border, they've got the pressure from the United States right now to provide some assistance in peacekeeping down there, which mm-hmm. I guess is kind of a loose phrase. So it's an ongoing and very fluid story. Great to get your perspective on this, Tasha. Thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks again.
Take care. Tasha Kiritin, Principal at Navigator. And book is a good read. It's called The Right Path, talking about the ups and downs of the conservative, small-c conservative movement in this country over the next little while, and trying to carve a path forward for conservative-thinking people. Anyway, good read when you get some time and a cold winter's day like this one.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on 900 CHML.
The Bill Kelly Podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also listen to The Bill Kelly Show weekdays from 9 till noon on 900 CHML. I'm Bill Kelly. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It's free, so you never miss an episode. And make sure that you rate and review.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.